that any of the people would work with stable coins. Like, it was completely off the table.
Yeah.
And then it just came out that, like, yeah, nobody gave a shit. They just literally did not understand the framing of, like, how this shit actually works in production. And I was like, oh God, that's on the table. Fuck, we can just YOLO a blockchain. That's piss easy. Like, let's get this guy going, and then we can build all the other shit that's actually the point of the whole party. Yeah, fine, fuck it. And then I raised this with somebody who actually knew how the regulation worked, and they were like, whoa, no, that goes directly to jail, my man. And I was like, bollocks. I thought
that was the playbook, Bill. You figure out tokenomics first, and then you figure out the use case.
I was like, I thought I had just found the cheat code. Totally wrong. Yeah, it turns out it's directly to jail.
Welcome to Game of Nodes, a weekly podcast from independent validator teams.
Hello and welcome to Game of Nodes, a weekly podcast from independent validator teams. This week, we're graced with a guest. We're doing new and improved, like Rice Krispies.
I know.
Like Corn Flakes being turned into Frosties, right? Do you have the tiger in America? Is that a thing?
We do. Yeah.
Do you have the tiger?
Yeah.
Okay. This is great.
Wait, what do you have there? Oh, yeah. Okay. We're coming together around Tony the Tiger. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, Tony the Tiger. That's the guy. I was like, ah, God, he's got a name. What's the name? Of course, it has to begin with a T, because children got to remember that shit.
You need a sharp T.
Children are already like ADD is crap from eating the Tony the Tigers. Tony the Tigers? Imagine if they were the shape of a tiger. That would be a much better Frosty. We've got Jasper from Seda joining us. He's like not shaped like Tony the Tiger.
Like a real guest.
Real guest.
like a real guest. Like, this is
really important to spell. For those listening on podcast players later, really important to be clear about this. Jasper is not shaped like a tiger. He's not breakfast cereal. That previous bit, that wasn't a bit.
Yeah.
No relation.
Someone who speaks at consensus and shit is on our show. That's pretty nice.
How's it going, Jasper?
I'm doing well. How are you guys?
Good.
The intro is very professional.
Yeah.
Love that.
Yep.
Very cool.
The outro is not going to be any better.
All right, let's go. I mean, I was talking about the intro song, the Frosty nice touch as well. Pleasure to be here, guys.
Yeah. I'm glad we made this happen. We've talked about it, I think, at Null, and I saw you at Consensus this year, right? That was this year, I think, in Austin.
It's going back some now. It's like at the start of the year.
No, but I think I met you before that too, because I think we met some, maybe it was Consensus even in 2023 or something too, because I forget. I know Mainnet launched in April. Is that right?
Yeah, we first met in Denver.
Oh, that's right. In ETH Denver. That's right. In February or something like that.
Yeah. And then also briefly at Consensus.
Yeah. And when did we start testnet? Was that this year still, or was that 2023? Yeah. Was that all this year?
It might have been all this year. It might have been end of 2023.
Wow.
And then, yeah, I think Mainnet followed testnet pretty soon. And then the sort of like real Mainnet took a lot longer than expected.
Right. That's right. At least, I mean, the chain was moving. We had something to build on, right? And then exactly. Now you guys have been building up the blocks. I know we'll talk about that a little bit too. So, yeah, that's cool. Well, I'm glad that we made this happen, because I know we were talking about it for a bit. And that's cool. Yeah. So, well, no. What are you doing, dude?
Well, no.
Are you working on something? Are you fixing like your SATA notes? You're like, shit, I'm missing blocks on SATA right now.
I just want to also observe again. You know, this won't make much sense if you're not watching the stream. But Null's really washed out. Like, the general vibe for the cameras on the show, like, is kind of like mid tier webcam, a kind of like warm orange kind of tone to the webcam, slightly fuzzy, occasionally, like, especially in my case, occasionally misfocusing. Usurper looks like he has a more expensive webcam. Null is like, okay, this is a really specific reference, but Null is like the Final Cut Pro X filter combat, right? It's washed out.
I know.
It's grainy.
It's all grainy.
He's got a buzz cut, basically. I mean, we're talking like,
it's a very specific fucking
the vibe
you're painting.
The vibe of the way Null is framed, plus the kind of color and lighting of the room that he's in, is, and we go now to a pre-recorded video from the shooter.
There you go. Did you add a little red there?
Couldn't handle the shade.
Get out of the shade. So now we've gone pink.
Where's your, like, I
look beautiful.
The reason I have this foo-foo iPhone thing is because I got that from you. You're not doing, you don't do that anymore. You don't have the nice bokeh going on and like some highlights and shit.
You know, I need to like work out a better mounting mechanism because I got sick of fucking duct tape in my phone to my monitor. So
yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah. It does have a very beautiful picture, but it also holds up my phone so I can't use it. And then.
Right. I know.
Like I can't fucking like.
Multitask.
It's,
like,
I'm scared that I'm going to break my, my monitor at some point because the whole screen goes very fucked when you're like peeling that duct tape off.
So, were you really actually duct taping it?
Yeah, like straight to the fucking screen.
It's like the most Australian thing I've ever seen.
I don't know another way to do it.
They have like arms and shit with just like clamps.
Give
on
a bit
them.
Of stickeroo to the croc, and then you put the croc on the monitor, and then Robert's your father's brother.
I love the only option in your head is like duct tape. There's duct tape, and I don't know what other fuck I could do with this. There's no other way I can hold this phone up.
Knife on the desk. There's no other shit
I can do. Yeah.
Because, you know, we all have duct tapes and big knives on the desk.
We do.
Well, how else you can play knifey spoonie?
Yeah. Look it. This is my son's, this is a Halloween thing though, because I could actually bend it. So
that's not a knife.
That's not a knife. It's been floating around here for like a week. See?
Jesus Christ. Why is there a knuckle
no, it's just a fidget toy now. It's a plastic fidget toy.
Yeah, I was gonna say if you had like a Leatherman or something, like, you know, that's quite a normal, just corner of the desk type thing. But geez.
Nothing that goes stabby stabby around here.
As soon as you get to knuckle duster, that's like,
mm-hmm. I know, or even plastic ones. There you go, right there.
Yeah, kind of different level that one.
Yeah, well, if a kid's under 15, man, you gotta keep that shit out of there. They'll just try it out. Like, how sharp is this
knife? Smack each other around.
Yeah, exactly. Like. So those are brass knuckles, huh? How does that work?
How's that? We punch each other. What's the Simpsons one where it's they go to Boy Scouts and Bart's just doing it to get a knife, but he's fucking around so he doesn't get the knife. And they say, oh, you got to read this knife safety book.
Oh, yeah.
And the time it takes him to read the knife safety book, he goes around, he sees all the stuff happening. He's like, everywhere I go, it seems like people are having fun with knives.
That is that one.
Oh, that's the one where it's not Dr. Nick, is it? It's Hibbert, like, does like a tracheotomy or something, doesn't he, with a penknife? And everybody's like, yay, they're cheering. He's like, don't cheer me, cheer the knife. Oh, man. That so, I reckon, is going to be the best bit of fatherhood, is rewatching all of the good
Simpsons, although I can't convince any of my kids that seasons 3 to 6 are the best.
Really?
Yeah, it's tough. Like, they still like they watch a couple new ones. I'm like, no, let's watch the new ones, because the ones I pull up obviously look like shit because they're all off, like, you know, they're all like early 90s. But yeah, we just watched like Camp Krusty a couple times. We watched and then also like Gabbo. Like, Gabbo is like my favorite episode of all time, and I just can't get them to like it. It's really disappointing.
Everybody has a different favorite episode.
Like, they're like, who's Luke Perry? I was like, well, all right. Well,
At the time.
Going through a sandpaper museum was pretty funny. Like, yeah, like the House of Acid.
Like, well, at the time, it was the fashion.
Like, who's Luke Perry?
It was the fashion to make jokes about Luke Perry.
My face, my beautiful face. So, yeah, Jasper.
Yes. What's your favorite Simpsons episode? Come on.
Do you have one?
Oh, man. Putting me on the spot, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I like the movie. I can't name an episode.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about the movie, actually.
I love the game, Hit and Run. good freaking game.
Do you remember the old arcade game?
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
The four-person,
I used to play
right?
That when I was a kid at, like, it's always at caravan parks and shit. I don't know what you call them over there, trailer parks.
Yeah,
but that was games room when you go put the money in it.
That was a four person where it was like you walked around, yeah. And it was like, it was basically like a fight type of game.
Yeah, you just like, go, you know, pick up hammers and fucking smash people with them.
Defining Cosmos memory for me is being in a video game bar with a bunch of OGs way back and Prague maybe, and playing the Simpsons game. Like, honestly, that was with like Juno Swap Ben, maybe Meow, maybe Jake, a couple of other people. That game was just endless, though. after a while, you were just like, ooh, okay, this is obviously a quarter. You know, one of those games where it's just designed to suck in your quarters endlessly.
Yeah.
And you're already sick of it, but you're still going 100%.
Like, so, yeah. Sorry, I did not have a better answer, but.
There's a lot of Simpsons chat on here.
So there is a bit. So Jeff, maybe I guess we could talk serious. Maybe if you want, can you? I'm not sure if everyone who listens to us knows that much about SATA or yourself and things like that. You want to do a little, like just like a little background on what we're building and maybe we could talk. You know, we can get into other stuff too, but maybe some background would be good.
Yeah, very gladly. So I joined the space in 2017. Started off doing sort of contract work, built some NFT stuff back in the day, like in 2017, 2018. Like, I guess in today's terms, it would have been like a play to earn NFT game back then. Mm-hmm. The reason why we were building it was because we were hired by Ethereum Foundation to work on Plasma. So for all the new kids, like back when Ethereum did not have any use cases on it live yet, people were already concerned with scaling it. So people were already trying to build L2s. And back then, there was no such thing as rollups. The sort of like leading technologies back then were like payment channels, state channels, and this hip new thing called Plasma, which is making a little bit of a comeback with sort of like the CK advancements that's been happening. But yeah, so I was working on one of the Plasma clients. Back then, because there were no applications, as I said, there was no use for Ethereum's composability yet necessarily, because people weren't sure what they want to build or want to use, really. So there was no concern of sort of like fragmentation, and that sort of shows the lack of foresight in sort of like the ETH rollup scaling idea that sort of like sustained. Anyway, well, one of our products was being demoed at ETH Berlin in 2018, and I met my co-founder there, Peter. We started building products in the space, started on the sort of like consumer side, trying to build applications, kept running into sort of like infrastructure that was shit, that made it so that we couldn't build what we wanted to build. And so we sort of like fell down that rabbit hole, trying to basically build better infra so that we could build the applications that we wanted. And ended up stumbling on this huge problem called the Oracle problem. We built a few Oracle products. Oracles essentially meaning getting data that's not on a blockchain, in a as trustless as possible way. Mm-hmm. So we built two Oracle products. One of them was a first party Oracle under the Flux brand, and one of them was a optimistic Oracle, similar to UMA, if you guys are familiar, or back then it was actually based on Augur, to settle some of our financial markets that we were building at the time. And the first party Oracle actually really took off. So during last sort of like DeFi bull run, we were securing almost $4 billion with that across a mix of L1s and L2s.
Wow.
Or like kind of L1s, L2-ish. And we ran into a problem where we had sort of like issues horizontally scaling this data across mm-hmm. many different chains. And we figured either we will become one of the other Oracle providers out there and we have to hire huge BD teams and huge integration teams and start charging outrageous fees to support and prioritize certain networks, or we will try to come up with a technical solution to this problem. Me being cocky, thinking I can solve this, no problem. We started building what has now become SATA, which is sort of like programmable oracles. So allowing people to spin up their own data feeds and accessing the data from any chain. So sort of like infinite horizontal scaling, infinite possibility for data feeds. And for that, we needed our own chain, which is how I met you guys.
Right.
So we're building that on the Cosmos stack.
Why'd you guys pick the Cosmos stack?
Good question. A lot of people now would have probably considered an L2 instead. We did not, mainly for finality reasons. If you're building a decentralized Oracle network, it's pretty important to have fast finality on the data, and rollbacks could be quite detrimental. also having a centralized sequencer sequence and sort of like decide what data hits the chain when, we felt was not necessarily in line with what we were trying to build.
Yeah. Any regrets?
Always, but not for picking Cosmos, no.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the main regrets are more with, like, you know,
validator
how
selection.
You... Sorry?
Validator selection and choosing the ship.
No, also actually quite happy with that. I think...
you do have a good val set. Yeah, we talked about that. We talked about early days in the testnet. Like, you guys... Stefan, I think, picked a lot of those, right? And he did a lot of interviews. But, like, when we first got in there, like, because you guys kept it pretty quiet on who else was in there. And I think we didn't even talk about it. I think Noel and I maybe knew, and maybe Schultz knew or something like that. But after we got in there, we started to realize that it was a really tight group early on. It was cool.
Yeah, we got good advice.
Yeah.
We found a good group of people and then sort of, like, used sort of, like, you guys as alpha on, like, who we should get in the set.
Or
like,
it was really...
can't miss in the set.
It was very little drama, I think, to mainnet.
Yeah.
I thought, like, upgrades and, like, restarts and this and that. And, like, there was very little drama when it came to communication and, like, we needed to do something, it got done. Like, that actually worked really well.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to stir some more shit up soon, but it shouldn't be bad.
No, it's good. No, I think that's good. That means it's progress, right?
Tell
us about, like, programmable oracles. Like, I know it's a leading question, but, like, tell me, explain that to what that really means.
Yeah. So today, if you want an oracle on your chain, you have to talk to business people and you'll have to convince them to launch their oracle on your network.
Yep.
And then if you have more exotic wishes for data than their sort of like standard set, you'll have to pay them to add those feeds to their offering, and that can get really expensive. It doesn't scale well, and that's where sort of like the programmability comes in. So what we've done is we've essentially built these things called Oracle programs that allow people to deploy what is essentially a WASM binary for the nerds out there, but it's essentially a set of instructions that says, hey, fetch data from the following places, aggregate it in the following way, and then collect all of the results of the queries and aggregate it again in XYZ way. And as soon as that lands on our network, it becomes finalized. And from there, you can prove Oracle state on any L1 or L2 using our sort of like interrupt solution that we've built, mm-hmm. which is kind of a one-way IBC connection. If we want to keep it Cosmos termy, mm-hmm. But it doesn't require IBC.
And then that programmable side, so that's the demand side, where if I want a feed on something, right? I like to your point. So I'd say I want, let's say something that's on chain. I want to pull something out of Radium, right? And I want the specific price pair that I want to use in my DApp on a different chain, right? And so I'm gonna go grab this price pair from Radium from a couple different providers that might be providing that, because I don't want to trust one, right? So I'm gonna pull those three. I'm gonna take them all. I'm gonna divide by I'm gonna add them and divide by three and get an average. I'm gonna do this at block speed, right? Once every X seconds or whatever the hell it is, right? And be able to do that. So that's a contract that I can write to do that, right?
We don't call them contracts, but yes.
Oh, what do you call them?
It's programs. It's not necessarily a smart contract. It is like a binary that's executed by a set of nodes.
Okay. All right. So that part I see. How does the discovery side work? Like if I want those Radium feeds, how the hell do I find those Radium feeds? Like what's the provider side look like?
Yeah. So there is two options. You can go public data providers. So find some sort of public RPC node that has Solana coverage and try to use that.
So I could just add that as an endpoint. Like, I don't need to do anything with that. I could just say, here's Radium. I'm going to use a Solana public endpoint on mainnet API or beta, whatever the fuck they call it, and just add it in and say, I'm just going to pull it from the data source.
Yes. That's definitely a way to do it. If you need to bootstrap,
or it could be one of many sources I use. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And but if you want a little bit more reliability, we also have this possibility for RPCers to provide data, RPC providers to provide data to SATA directly. What they do is essentially they open up a portal, or we call it a proxy, which allows the SATA network to query their data permissionlessly, and they would get paid on the back end for that. So the idea is that some of the gas that's used would go to the data providers in that case, right? So if you want to talk about Solana, we're working with some of the bigger Solana RPC providers as well to make sure that, for example, Radium data would be fully accessible.
I gotcha. Okay, and what about off-chain data? Like, what if I want to grab pricing data from CoinGecko or from Binance or something else like that? Can I, as a provider, provide that data on-chain if I have that data?
Yeah, Binance actually has public APIs, so you can also do that permissionlessly. But for some of the more, if you want a little bit more sophisticated data, we also work with professional sort of price feed, for example.
Yeah, I don't know if I can. Aggregators. I'm sure I can't resell those as part of that. That seems like jail time.
Like, no, you can.
Can I?
Yeah.
We have a lot of, data providers.
There's like some. There's probably some fair use ideas
That'd be good to look at.
You know, like you have to bend it. You can't just resell just like raw Binance data. Mm. But if you throw it through some sort of aggregation schema, then I think it's yours.
Interesting. That's cool. That's pretty cool.
So it's a whole business, actually.
That is a whole business. And so that discovery, and I think you guys are creating like portals or something like that to be able to allow individuals who might create programs to go find those types of sources, right? So
exactly,
if Null and I or Frey and I or whatever else are providing endpoints for Base or this or that, that there is a way for those to be discovered to say, oh, Null can provide this at this rate, right? And it can compete with me at that, you know, rate minus one type of thing.
Yep, exactly. So there's like essentially docs that allow you to query like, hey, we want cross-chain data for these chains, and these are the following providers. This is how they're priced. This is who they are.
I got you.
Type thing. Yeah,
that's cool. So is that, and what part of that's live now?
The docs are not
close, right?
But there is some data floating around already during our hackathon that we just hosted with Encode Club. Some of it was used. That was actually a pretty wild experience. So from the very beginning, I've been saying that the most exciting thing about SATA to me is like what use cases developers will come up with that I can't really think of, because this question you always get, right? Like either on podcasts or investors, they're like, oh, what use cases are most exciting to you? And like the most obvious ones at the time would be like, oh, you know, price feeds for long tail assets on like new L2s.
Yeah.
But yeah, my answer was always like the things that devs will build that I can't even think of. And I always thought that it was a little bit of a cop-out answer, and I felt that it was received that way, but it's true, so I'll stick with it. And during the hackathon, we really saw this. We saw people build use cases that I could have never thought of. Like, I think 50% of the use cases were actually AI use cases, where people used, for example, ChatGPT they use SATA as a connection for smart contracts to fully autonomously connect with LLMs. So right now you have all of these like agentic Twitter bots, et cetera, which are usually just a private key on a server that somebody can turn off, and nobody really knows if it's really the LLM like creating these tweets or like doing these things on chain.
Yeah.
Where with SATA, you can actually do it like provably. And I think that is quite exciting and something that I briefly thought of, but I didn't think was so close.
That's really interesting. So they're using, that's not really the original intent, right? But basically, an oracle, I guess, is one version of a SATA. The oracle is one version of SATA's capability of taking and creating a provable structure around a request and a response, right? And so they're applying that to AI, or they're applying that to anything else that needs that provable request response type structure at a specific time, at a specific height, with a specific parameters, yada yada, right?
Exactly. So you have a certain prompt. People can buy the prompts. Some people build a prompt marketplace for smart contracts.
Yeah.
So that smart contract can purchase the rights to access a prompt on chain for, I don't know, X amount of times. I thought it was quite cool. I think it's the first sort of possibility of like truly agentic smart contracts that are like fully LLM controlled, basically, right? So one of the things we wanted to build is like throw some money into one of these smart contracts that doesn't even have an exit hatch and just like make it do things and just like see how well it gets. Just like allow anybody to ping it to do like, I don't know, prompts within certain parameters and then see what happens. I think we'll see that pretty soon.
That's, I guess randomness would be another one of those, right? Like anything else that you're, I guess any of those types of things that would be the idea of being able to do it.
RIP noise.
Yeah, RIP noise. Yeah, exactly. But any one of those. Yeah, okay. That's pretty interesting, actually. So I guess that kind of opens up the market, right? For what you guys, I mean, knowing that it's a different use case, I guess it's still same use of that technology, but now that probably opens up different avenues for you guys to think about, right?
In terms of how the oracles work, given that they're, if I've understood correctly, they're uploaded like WASM binaries, how is the code, how do you like guarantee determinism in those uploads? Is it similar to like a smart contract framework where there's a VM with restricted command set or something like that?
And very much so. Like,
is that very similar to a smart contract VM in practice, or is it like, and how... I guess what's the underlying question here? The underlying questions here is, I suppose, how do you guarantee determinism is like a VM type situation, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then so, if you wanted to like develop your own, is it conceptually similar for like a developer to like similar to like, if you're going to write a smart contract, you write something, compile it.
Boom, yeah.
You've got your Oracle.
Exactly. So the VM is ran by what we call overlay nodes, which are like query and compute nodes that indeed are expected to sort of like run it in this constrained environment. I think that a lot of the deterministic nature of blockchains goes out the door as soon as you allow them to query sort of like arbitrary APIs, because, you know, like if there's a few like milliseconds difference between price feed queries, you're going to get different answers. So that's where the aggregation of things becomes really important, right? So it is a less deterministic version of smart contracts, simply because of, you know, there's some time equation there that doesn't really match.
So how does the aggregation work? Is that like leader-based consensus among the nodes or something? Or is it aggregation as specified in the code at runtime of the smart contract collecting the data? Like how does that...
The latter.
Okay.
Yes. So we have like two phases. We call them the execution phase and the tally phase. And in the execution phase, like all the nodes that you elect, like depending on the replication factor for the data, so you can elect how many nodes you want to have run the program. And they will run it in parallel. And then in the tally, you sort of like filter out outliers or however you really want to deal with the data, depending on the use case, basically, right? So yeah, it is sort of like a two-step process. So you have like the replication factor, query and execute the data, it lands on chain, and then the tally is executed by the SATA validator set. So there's determinism, right? Because as soon as the outcomes of the execution phase land on chain, after that, you get deterministic outcomes.
So that executor side, you said I can pick multiple different executing nodes to be able to run that. They all run the same job though, right? So like I might have five different data sources. I pick three nodes to run those data sources. I get 15 results back, and then my tally, I go do that work.
Yep. That's definitely one way you could program it.
Yeah, however you want to do it. Yeah.
How does it work in terms of like if you're specifying nodes, it's a subset of the validator set that are going to run that code?
So the end goal is that it will be a completely different set. The idea is that the validator set does the tally and sort of like does the settlement of a lot of these things, and staking, slashing, et cetera, is done sort of like on the Cosmos chain. The execution side of things is actually meant to be done by a separate larger set potentially of nodes, because we don't, we feel like that is probably a better outcome eventually. But in the beginning, we will also probably have a sort of like smaller set of these execution nodes, which probably will have very high overlap with our.
So you have effectively a superset of nodes that is doing the actual computation, and then you're using the blockchain layer for kind of pure settlement, essentially.
Yeah.
Like, the same way to see it, you had proofs or something like that you were testing.
Right? Mm-hmm. Exactly. So one way to put it is like, we have a secondary layer, the overlay network that deals with sort of like non-deterministic nature, right? They queried mm-hmm. like a bunch of different data, mm-hmm. but as soon as it lands on chain, it's quite important to have determinism enter back into the mix, because otherwise you get like really strange slashing conditions on the network. And that's what we don't want.
So that overlay network is like what I'm guessing, like just a bunch of like gossiping agents that are running a VM, something like that. And they're all just aggregating that down and then saying to the validator, the validator's connect to them saying, hey, what's the latest thing? What's the latest news? And they go, yeah, here's what we've heard from the network.
Yeah. So one other way to look at it is sort of like intents and solvers, right? So you have sort of like the intent to have this program executed, and then you have like a solver net on top of it, which is like the overlay network that actually performs the tasks and then reports their outcomes back.
So how does the incentivization work for those two layers? Because they sound like they could in theory be quite different, but in practice they're, I would guess, always going to be validators, right? Because it's only going to be the validators who are making money.
Yeah, no. So the fees would be split between the two layers, right? So like part of the fees would go to the execution set, and part of the fees would go to. So there's like sort of mm-hmm. like three stakeholders that need to be paid, right? So you have the data providers; they need to make money. Then you have the execution nodes, and then you have the validator nodes. And like one of the reasons why we're probably launching with a smaller subset of like the execution nodes is because we don't want to add too much complexity there. So like having overlap between the validators makes a ton of sense there. But in the future, we sort of like want to open that up to like a completely green field, potentially have hundreds of thousands of executor nodes where we only have like a smaller subset running the Cosmos chain.
What's the economic model for how that all interacts? Like, is it, at what point does the tokenomics support the viability of a standalone overlay network? I mean, because kind of being facetious here, but also I suppose we have been in a bear market for some time and whatnot, and in Cosmos in particular, there's been this kind of persistent problem of economic incentives breaking down.
Yeah.
For infrastructure providers. And so there is, I think, an ongoing conversation about whether fees can ever induce the right, fees, and by in that case, I kind of really mean gas fees and the various derivatives yeah. thereof, can actually ever really, on any network other than maybe Ethereum or Bitcoin, amount to much for infrastructure providers, right?
So let me answer your question with a question. Well, first, let me think this through. Like, my question to your question would be: there is examples of very high throughput, low gas chains that are now starting to generate a lot of revenue, and that revenue does not come from necessarily gas, but it comes from something else, and that something else would be priority fees, right? Mm-hmm. So, sort of like, if you look at Solana, like. Running a validator would have been extremely unprofitable until there's actually MEV, yeah. right, on these yeah. chains. So this is something we've thought about a lot historically, sort of like how do you create sort of like economic network effects where you get sort of like this positive feedback loop from valuable traction, right? Because that's really what you want to see. And so what we started to do pretty early, and we're working with some pretty cool teams on this, is think about how to auction off valuable order flow from Oracle specifically, and capture some of the MEV that those Oracle outputs sort of like generate on the destination chains. So yeah, we're working with a team called Fastlane on this, mm-hmm. where we would use something in the direction of application specific sequencing, where the Oracle is the application to sort of like auction off data flow for sort of like valuable Oracle updates.
Right, but in the general case, MEV doesn't apply to Oracle feeds.
It really does.
Well, because there's an argument here that says that if you're a user that participates in an Oracle workflow where there's MEV in it, by participating and not bidding, you are having excess value extracted from your participation by people who, from your point of view, are competitors in the game, right? And they're extracting excess value by doing any number of things, including, you know, interfering with your transaction, because they have full visibility not only of the Oracle flow, of transactions related to the Oracle flow, right, as well as any contingent transactions. And we know at this point that maybe less so in, you know, some Cosmos chain, but in high value networks, shall we say, there are now quite sophisticated automated attack vectors that do leverage full public data, right? And go far beyond, you know, what we were looking at 5-6 years ago, where it was like, you know, simple sandwich attacks and things like that, you know, to flash loans to blah 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 blah. There's like, you know, and that's all bots, you know, so much of that is bots. Mm-hmm. So yeah,
this will be bots.
So there's a kind of open question there of like, you know, what is your average user going to like MEV always has this tension, right? Is the average user can get wrecked by the presence of MEV, right?
Yeah.
Because MEV can't provably, it doesn't, MEV is a complicated subject actually, but it's like,
definitely.
Its analogs in traditional order book flow are obviously mm-hmm. there for a reason, mm-hmm. but they also, the equivalent of order book flow does not really exist in systems that are expected to handle payments. So there's a difference between like stock order book flow, right? Which is relevant to say like a DEX versus anything you expect to ultimately be settled as if it was a payment or a credit issuance, which, and this, you know, this is maybe a fundamental problem of cryptocurrencies, that we treat them interchangeably as a payment mechanism, a store of value, and also as some kind of credit thing that's like a stock or something like that. But do you think that like, how is that? Is there any kind of accounting for that in the way that you've architected for like these flows, how they interact? Because everything's public, right? From the point of view of the interacting users, where the feeds are going, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
For sure. So yeah, it's public, but the idea of what we're working on with these, with sort of like application specific sequencing, is that the right to publish the data will not always be permissionless for all applications. So if you have high value applications that generate high value Oracle flow, you can essentially auction off the right to bundle your MEV bundles with the Oracle update directly. There's a pre-Oracle update state and a post-Oracle update state. And if you know that in the post-Oracle update state, there is value to be extracted, that value makes sense to be auctioned off. And some of it should go back to the application and in return to the user. And some of it should be internalized by the Oracle. And that is sort of like this whole application-specific sequencing that we're working on with the Fastlane team. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it's definitely, this is all very sort of like new stuff that people have been thinking about for a long time. We've not seen it in the wild much. There's a ton of these like OEV projects coming out. And I think it is a good way to sort of like get more sustainable and sort of like a different form of, I don't know, revenue for middleware. Actually, and then there's a few other ways, right? So first you have like gas fees, and the more demand for the data, that will scale up. Arguably, historically, that hasn't been too interesting on many Cosmos chains, so we're looking for other venues as well, right? So if you look at SATA, sort of like a two-sided marketplace where you have data providers and then you have data consumers, there's like multiple levers you can pull in order to try and like extract more revenue from it. Like another way to do it would be to take a few basis points off of the data providers' side of things, right? So data providers, if they earn a lot of money through the network, maybe a percentage of that goes back to the validators. Then if the order flow is specifically valuable, so it's used in like lending protocols and perps, for example, where there is a ton of value to be extracted, then that's where we'll see revenue. And if it's just a bunch of super long tail data that, I don't know, like is on I don't know, like 10,000 chains, then that will also earn revenue. So I think as long as you have like many paths to create sustainable revenue, like that's very important. I agree that just saying gas fees is probably not the way today.
Right. And is my Oracle feeds public? Is that right? the results on my feed? Is that public? Is that available if it's discovered or no?
No.
It's not.
It can only be queried by our network. So that's, if you look at what the portal or the proxy does, is it essentially checks inbound requests to see if the requester was actually elected to query that data. So it will only be publicized to people that like pay for it.
Okay. All right. Okay. So there's no piggybacking on that or anything else associated with that. Like I can see what data you're using to be able to make decisions, you know, at the same time you are, right? Like those.
In theory, there might be some, but I think that would be so complicated that it defeats the purpose.
Okay. Okay.
Unless it's like extremely high value data. And if we get to that point, I'm very happy to come up with some other solution.
Right.
At that point, we can think about, I don't know, some cool privacy use cases, but that's a good problem to have.
Yeah. Then you could have the same feed being hopefully paid for by multiple different buyers, yep. Right?
Exactly.
Where you're basically creating a feed market where I might publish something that I want others to be able to, that others might be interested in, right? Who might be, it might be cheaper for them to be able to piggyback on something that I'm providing versus everybody re-querying the same shit over and over, which is basically what happens on every other Oracle today.
That's a market.
Yeah. All right. So Frey, did you get that question answered? Were you poking for a hole there or something? You just don't believe in gas, I think, is the thing.
Hole. Yeah, I don't. I obviously I don't believe in gas. Like that's the.
But it's a weird thing though, because in this situation, if I'm running this query, right, I'm generating gas on like every single block, and like over and over and over and over, like I'm constantly getting and pinging for updates, right? Which is very different than like traditional applications where me as a user, I might, you know, I'm doing 6 transactions a month. This I'm doing 20 transactions in 10 seconds, right? And for forever. So from that perspective, for something that I'm consuming as like a subscription like this, where that's not the right word, but you know what I mean, right? Where it's something that I'm constantly querying, that argument has a little bit more value, right? Because that is something that I'm actually using, not like not just like one time, hey, I'm paying 4 cents to Osmosis for a trade.
Sure, it's a little bit closer to like, I don't know, an on-demand compute kind of model.
Correct.
Yeah. I think the economic criticism for gas is like pretty straightforward. It's that generally speaking, it doesn't make a lick of sense until it gets out of hand, at which point it doesn't make a lick of sense. Like the bit in the middle where gas is sustainable as an incentive mechanism is like such a knife edge that it defeats the purpose. And the example that I'm always given, right, whenever I talk about gas in any kind of meaningful way, I'm always given the example of IP packet routing, right? Uh-huh. Which is like, you know, that there was a time when people, you know, really, and we're talking like, I was about to say before I was born, but it would have been about when I was born, there were discussions of like, you know, with more mass adoption of the internet, how are we going to know about getting a packet routed like from here to Japan or whatever?
Yeah.
And the answer was everybody just carries everybody else's packets, right? Marginal mm-hmm. cost is zero, treat it as zero, carry each other's packets, move on, find out a way of making money from something else, right. Which turns out quite easy,
get a certain grant. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Quite
there's
easy.
A, to there's a lovely
structure. You know?
There's a lovely parallel here between the sort of like, almost like commoditization of packet rounding and the commoditization of block space in
at least the ETH
ecosystem. Like,
I mean, and there's also there's also a whole conversation about like gas is kind of based on this idea that we're in a low trust environment, or potentially like, you know, some people even go as far as to say like a zero trust environment, and that's just not how blockchains work. They proof of stake blockchains in particular. So actually, I should roll that back, and I say proof of work is maybe a slightly different dog. It's possible to run that in a provably lower trust environment, I think, than most proof of stake. But you know, proof of stake blockchains are consortium blockchains. They're the only arguments that a consortium blockchain and a proof of stake blockchain are different is that a validator has to be permissioned to you know, do a proof of authority blockchain or a consortium blockchain, if you like. The language is different, but they're conceptually the same thing. But the reality is most validator operators can only enter a proof of stake your typical kind of proof stake chain, no matter which ecosystem, if there's enough space in the set, right? And what determines space in the set? Typically a foundation delegation, at which point we are really talking about a consortium blockchain with other steps, right? The other prime definition, where there is one, of consortium blockchains is that the validators are chosen at Genesis, right? Which again, every blockchain validates its validator set at Genesis. I just knocked my phone straight on the floor. All those fucking months of Null taping his phone to the monitor doesn't knock it on the floor. I just had mine literally on the desk by me, and I just somehow managed to knock it fully off. Anyway, but like, you know, obviously all projects kind of, you know, validate the validators, weird sentence, do some due diligence on the validators that are going to be included in the Genesis file, right? So there's this kind of interesting tension where we sort of all pretend that it's super low trust, and yet it's sort of not, right? So then again, it's like, well, why are we optimizing for these incentive systems that assume an environment we're not in? And the answer is because we don't 100%, we haven't really worked out how to make a business model on some level that doesn't rely on that, or inflation, right? Which is the other dirty secret, is that that's kind of how everybody makes their money, right? Although it's not really that much
so far in Cosmos. Yes,
that's
the. I think that is the important caveat there. I think slowly, yes,
and many other proof of stake networks. I think the common denominator is profitability via emissions.
Yeah. But is there a chain where there's not, besides like proof of work chains? Is there any proof of stake chains where that's actually supported fully by not inflation?
No, I don't think inflation. But I think that if you look at sort of like ETH has been a good example at points, I think, where there was a substantial amount, up to 60% of validator revenue not coming from inflation.
Yeah.
I think Solana has been as well during some of the more sort of like hypey cycles. I think the thing is, if we boil it down, this seems like it's been a problem in Cosmos more than anything. Like it's a user problem,
hang on,
right? Like people just haven't been able to use it, right?
I did just think of one. DYDX doesn't rely on inflation. It's 100% user fees.
Good point.
Do you make any money on DYDX? Yeah.
Don't come around here with those fucking questions.
Not yet, guys. Come on.
I lose money in a different way entirely.
But I guess the interesting question, right, will be when there are, you know, you look at like a network like Near or something, and you know, again, it has a lot of the same teething problems. What I guess will be interesting is if whether some of the networks that have come out more recently that have incredibly high throughput, and if I may say so, a very, very nice consensus design. The whole DAG consensus thing is very nice. Like Sui and Aptos, like if they actually get a Solana-like adoption for any of the projects on them, and you see like, you know, a period of huge throughput, what will happen to fees if they're still dog shit? Then that's almost like that'll be the nail in the coffin. Like, what we did.
I think a great example of this is Hyperliquid, actually. Like, if you look at sort of like, I mean, let's not talk about the validator set in this case, but the idea of like having all the fees generated just from activities on a network, right? It's all trading fees that go to the validator set, if you will. Sort of like there is a definite path there where without inflation, it becomes like super, super profitable if you build like a decentralized Binance, right? Like having like a decentralized Binance that generates a ton of fees and has like a validator set. Like I think people would pay a significant sum to be one of the Hyperliquid validators today, right? And like earn those fees on those chains. And it would probably be a good business.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, at the moment, like basically the entire power of that chain is with the foundation, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. But well, that's what the
image is. With unnamed validators anyway. there's like a couple of others in there with some very insignificant voting powers, but so I mean that could be a good model, that could be a good business model anyway. If they do create a good product, are people looking for decentralization, or are they looking for a blockchain that does what they want it to do? So
well if you look at sort of like the application
decentralization, no,
yeah,
no, don't define decentralization.
That's
no,
a spectrum.
Don't.
To get back to that.
Well, I mean, in decentralization, do they want fault tolerance or do they want like, you know, anons everywhere to operate at? You know, so many different levels of it, and I don't think that necessarily that, you know, all of them have to be the decentralization goddess that we all look up to in Bitcoin or whatever. It's like, I think, you know, there's products that do a job, and if they do the job with a certain amount of, you know, fault tolerance and decentralization, then that's all they need to do. And then people make the choice. They say, is this where I want to put my, say, this whole thing's controlled by a group of people, but, you know, a little bit different in that it's, in some cases, a group of people that's not a business that I know who they are, but in some cases it is. So how is that different to putting your money into Chase Bank?
I mean, and are you looking for the answer? Because I can tell you mathematically, endogenously, the answer to your question is...
As a rhetorical question.
It's so close to zero, but it is zero. It is functionally zero, but it can't be zero because the probability must be slightly above zero. The probability that you won't be owned is the answer to your question.
Owned?
Well, so you asked the question of like, you know, whether it's better to have the decentralization goddess or a single organization owning your data. And I'm telling you, once you take time out of the equation and you put it on an axis where zero is won't ever be owned in the history of the universe and one is will be owned. The likelihood of ledger immutability is either one or zero, right? It can't be zero because it can't be zero, but it can be fractionally above zero. And no matter how decentralized you are in terms of like controlling entities, it will always be ever so slightly above zero if you take time out of the equation. Because that's not the factor that secures finality. What secures finality is social consensus over ledger state, ultimately, and trust, which is the same as any other credit system, right? Or stock or whatever. Because regulation, right, is this exogenous thing, or a government, or work, or taxes, right? Money coming into the system from some outside force, like people going to work, like walking to work, working, coming home, having made something. Those are all exogenous things that affect monetary systems and blockchains. When they're completely endogenous, they don't have any of that. So it all mathematically is just ever so slightly above zero.
And blockchains have taxes.
The reason it doesn't collapse is because everybody agrees that it won't collapse.
Blockchains have priority taxes.
Yeah, they do. Well, MEV now, yeah.
One more point to your question earlier, the fray was about sort of like how to create sustainability if you have like this giant overlay network versus the validator set, and that is that we don't have liveness expectations on the overlay network necessarily, so you can just shut it off if there is no revenue to be made. So it's more of a dynamic pool where that can turn on or turn off.
Right. Okay. So it's kind of similar to a mesh payment system type design, something like that, where you put up your node, it communicates with the swarm, you make transaction fees while people are attaching to your relayer, and when it's not, you turn off.
It's definitely a way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Loosely familiar, kind of familiar-ish with that kind of design. So yeah, I mean, it makes sense for sure.
All I know is I'm happy when, Ethereum gas fees are under $4, so I think I'm just beaten down, dude. When I do a transaction, it's under like $8 to send a token. I was like, this is fucking great. I love this blockchain. It's amazing. Just broken. It's all about setting expectations. That's all. You just gotta set expectations.
You tend to do like higher value transactions on Ethereum, though, right? It's not like
you really got to mean it.
Yeah, like I really want to do this.
It keeps the mempool low, really, right? Do. Yeah, you really like. It's like, all right,
the A grade degeneracy.
You really got to fucking mean it. You can't just flood the mempool with bullshit. Like, you really got to mean like whatever the hell.
I feel like you get like hosed a fair bit more in an exchange, though. Maybe you don't notice it as much because it's not as transparent without going and looking how much it costs you. But like, if you're just jumping in there to do some transactions that are high value and then jump back out of them, you've lost a fucking fair bit of your money by the time you get back out.
Have you ever noticed that like in most of the major, what's it called, cryptocurrency exchanges, that they, if you're in dumbass mode, where you just
you're rinsed.
You get fucking rinsed. Whereas if you just like Kraken's a prime.
Oh, yeah.
If you just go, am I thinking of Kraken? I'm pretty sure I'm thinking of Kraken. Coinbase. I know this is true of Binance.
Coinbase too, yeah.
Yeah, if you just go, if it's just like you have like some validator rewards or something and you're like, ah, fuck, just switch that to that. You will get absolutely, you'll be like, what the fuck am I getting charged a transaction fee? You jump over to the pro.
Yeah.
And it'll be like, yeah, like $3. And you're like, wait, what? This one was like $70. This was like $3.
Yeah.
Literally, what is, there is no difference in the two services being provided other than I found tax one.
That's the
no. I think the way they do the swap is different. Like I think the I think in the pleb mode, I think the
does it say that in the banner at the top? It just says pleb mode on.
Well, I think they're like swapping out their custody tokens and then replenishing them on the market. If that makes sense.
That's probably what they're
yeah. Right, so right, I think right, they right. build in a margin so they don't get rinsed.
Yeah,
only you get rinsed.
Yeah. That's a good point, right? They're not, there's no transaction. Yeah, there's no transaction behind that thing.
They're like taking that fucking 20 seconds of risk. So,
right.
Yeah, they definitely like give you a shit spread and then charge a 1% fee. At least Coinbase fees like 5x, I believe, if you use dummy mode versus pro mode.
But if you're like
outside of the spread,
if you're doing a swap, right, for $100,000 on fucking dummy mode, and you know, their little application algorithm goes and looks at the market depth and it's like, all right, so for $100,000 depth at an instant, like just hitting the market with it, I'm going to get rinsed by fucking 20%. Well, they're going to charge you that 20% plus a margin.
Plus another 20.
But if you go and set like a, you know, limit order in pro, then you're going to do a lot better as people eat it away over time. But, you know, it's either an instant swap, you go, fuck yeah, or you take the time risk yourself and go over there and do the work. Keep your $3.
You put
do the work.
You put a limit order in, and then it sits there for 6 months, like I do.
Yeah, putting in limit orders is like that's bull market behavior. Dude, for people that never learn.
My ability to pick 99% of the top is like unfucking believable, dude. I pick. Or
it's,
I should say 101%
of the top.
You tell
me what your limit is, and then I go and set my limit half a cent under that.
That's exactly what happens.
You know when Juno like inexplicably went up the other week, and I found that I had access to some, like literally before it collapsed. Like, so like kind of just maybe like a cent or two below the top. Market, not limit. Market.
So you market. Crushed the market.
You crushed it.
Coincidence? I think not.
Yeah, exactly. Like, maybe you're
whatever
you drained it.
10,000 Juno or something. I was like, just
you drained it.
I actually hit the top and it couldn't handle my fucking $1,000 of sell volume. So
just fully
crashed. I tanked it.
You tanked it.
It was going.
No, to be fair, I think I actually traded on Osmo into Atom, ate a bit of slippage.
There's got to be nothing in the tanks there, right? Juno to Atom, there's got to be nothing left.
I'm a responsible shitcoin trader.
Juno to Osmo to Atom, maybe?
Yeah. I can't believe anything in those.
There was enough liquidity
for your $90
when the degeneracy was happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. There wouldn't be today not to move $3,000 of Juno or whatever that is.
No. Have you heard of Calc Finance?
I think you told me about that.
Yeah, it's like, you know, the responsible way to move your shit coins.
Is that the
never heard of it?
That's the is that the one that does
it just like trickles it out. It's like,
yeah,
it'll sell like, you know, 100 every hour or something.
Either hour or daily kind of averages, right? It just
you can
trickles
pick
it
a
out.
Time frame.
And you could put a spread if it drops below 10%, then hold on to it or some shit, something like that.
Yeah, but the basic one is just dollar cost averaging in or out.
Yeah,
over time. Out. Yeah, it's just, like, you know, it's far more responsible than just smacking the fucking the pool with your, like, you know, bag of shit going. You're like, oh, oops.
Oops. This is just like null with his 18 billion Huawei. Oops.
Oops. There it goes.
Yeah, I don't have any Huawei anymore. I got rinsed on that fucking chain.
All my shit coins are gone.
It was good for the first weekend, though, wasn't it?
Hey.
You did it right that first weekend, didn't you?
Oh, in peak degen mode, yeah.
Oh, early Chihuahua days were good times.
happy days back in the big trades on on Huawei.
Good days of shit coins.
Hey man, but Huawei stop. Huawei swap is just around the corner. So,
Huawei what?
Huawei swap.
What's that?
You know, it's a meme at this point.
Oh, okay.
It's been coming for like fucking 2 years. Great news. Huawei swap's almost ready. 6 months later, just putting the finishing touches.
Months later,
getting ready for launch.
I know this is ridiculous because there are a lot of chains in Cosmos that don't have any devs left anymore, but are there any devs left on Huawei?
I do not know.
I have no idea.
I would be guessing at best. I know there's like some words get said in the Discord occasionally, but I don't know if that equals devs or not.
No clue.
Probably know them.
Probably not.
Presumably Jasper's got some devs over there at CETA. Sounds
they're
like under a chat.
They're holding him
for
up.
Sure. Huawei. No, I missed that one. I remember seeing it. Completely missed it.
Before your time? What year did you start looking into development in the Cosmos ecosystem? Like when did you rear your head?
I started to very seriously consider building CETA on Cosmos when the Cosmos 2.0 paper released.
Mm. Oh, okay. All right. That was controversial.
Yeah.
Tell me this.
Hot take.
Like how long ago did you start doing crypto full time? What's your like transition story to crypto from your daily?
That's a good story. So I was building another company in Web2 that was doing data analytics. And we were building sort of like bespoke dashboards on Facebook data. And after a year or so, we got acqui-hired by another team. And so the experience of building on a Facebook or like is quite terrible because they change their API access every 2 weeks. So instead of being able to, you know, innovate, you're constantly running around with tape trying to fix the things that worked 2 weeks before. Mm-hmm. And after in total like 1.5, 2 years of that got frustrating enough for me to be like, hey guys, hands off. And a few months after I left, Cambridge Analytica came out. It's like the news and people shut everything down. This was around, I don't remember exactly when, but right after that, I started pursuing crypto full time. And the reason was because I saw smart contracts as sort of like immutable API interfaces that if we would have tried to build what we were trying to build on top of Facebook's API, on top of these interfaces, I could sort of picture how much that would empower developers. So I really came into the space because I was super excited about composability of sort of like devs and their applications and sort of like the permissionless and immutable nature of these API interfaces. And that is also one of the reasons why I built CETA, is because with Ethereum fragmentation happening, it's also one of the reasons why we haven't really talked about this, but why we're so excited about chain abstraction, like trying to restore some of the composability or at least the feeling of composability in like this fragmented environment is like quite exciting to me, because that is what got me into the space and what kept me excited about it. And it is very much broken in the fragmented L2 space. And Cosmos has some tape, right? Like with IBC. But I think, yeah, the next frontier of applications will be like intent-based. And they will abstract away like all of the cross-chain stuff.
There's a lot of people working on chain abstraction at the moment, isn't there? There's like, well, the two that come to mind is like you guys and Zion.
Zion, like,
and, but Noma, there is there's definitely more. Yeah,
that, just, but it is yeah. that
Omni,
yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, definitely, yeah. No, there's a ton of people building in the vertical now, and it's
I do like I see your like I see your logo a lot, like you know, with you know, when people do like a Medium or a blog or something about another chain, like I see you guys and Zion pop up all the time as like working with those other ecosystems. So, and yeah. I guess that particular subject does take like a lot of collaboration across different ecos, yeah. and different ideas to be able to make it work in the end.
And having a single standard to access data that's all comes from the same sort of source. So you get like data entropy across all different chains is like extremely powerful within sort of like this chain abstracted fragmented ecosystem. So that is is why we fit in pretty well.
Imagine the first crypto ISO standard. Who's going to write that?
The Frank.
Null, that already is a distributed ledger ISO standard.
Is there? Well, my bad.
No, well, to be fair, there's a vocabulary. There isn't standard, because standard for what, right?
So, Jesper, it sounds like actually your story into coming into crypto is quite different to what a lot of people's usually is. Like, I think the standard story
Listen, I also bought shitcoins in 2016 and saw go up like crazy. Right?
There we go.
That's what we wanted to hear.
We're all wondering. Yeah. That's the real story.
So what I mean is that, like, for a lot of us, me included, it's like it begins with a dabble. And
you stay for the
tech. It becomes a side hustle. And then at some point you have to make a choice between dumping your daily job to becoming like, you know, a full-time crypto participant. But it sounds like you were in a completely different position where you were like, well, this other thing's done now. I want to do this other thing, which sounds much better. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so I was very crypto curious, if you will, but as a programmer, like, I felt like I had an edge. And it was really early, right? Like, I'm probably one of the earlier Solidity devs that were out there, like 2017, like full time. Like, there weren't that many of us. So there was like, I felt like I was early, and I had an edge back then as a programmer to like try and learn more about this. And through my previous endeavors, I got an opportunity to sort of like teach myself how to write Solidity, and then sort of like fell into the hole from there. So came for the initial like fucking red coin or whatever the fuck I bought in 2016 and that went up like 10x, and I felt like a genius, and then stuck around because
I'm an investing god. I'm gonna be a billionaire.
I'm just gonna hold on to this.
Those conversations were had when I was like fucking 20.
If it went this high, it could clearly go higher.
Yeah,
it's funny here in Australia, like in the hype cycles, there's like construction's pretty big here, and like construction and mining, and there's like all these people who, you know, drive excavators and this type of stuff, and they've all got these little side hustles, and a lot of it is crypto, right? Like these kinds of operators and stuff. A lot of times, like, you know, you sit in a cabin doing nothing for a fair while, like during the day. You might be just, especially if you're a crane driver, you might just be sitting there fucking waiting for like 5 hours for someone to rig something up, but you have to sit in the machine. So they're in there like, you know, on Binance or whatever. And then every now and then you'll get like one of these dudes and they're like, fuck this, I'm leaving construction. I've made 20 grand in a week in crypto. And then,
you know, those never end well.
Then like fucking 2 months later, they're like, back looking for their job. You know, maybe I wasn't an investment genius after all. Maybe I was just buying in a bull market.
That's funny.
Yeah. I've met multiple people like that as well, like in the early crypto days. I don't have many success stories there, to be honest. Like
I know more people that got wrecked, I think, than made it. But well,
that's,
I guess,
how it works.
I guess, to be fair, there's quite a few Atom OGs or Cosmos OGs who have done okay for themselves financially.
Oh, yeah.
But a lot of people, I have like a particularly dark one where somebody I knew from my local tech scene was early on Bitcoin, and actually who I got my first Bitcoin from way back in there, like 2011, 2012, something like that.
This man gave you a Bitcoin?
No, I did some.
Hey,
I did
man,
some work.
Have a Bitcoin.
Fucking story before.
You get some Bitcoin.
And then I did some work for them, and they said you can be paid like whatever, $150 in pounds, or you can be paid $200 in Bitcoin. And I was like, what can I do with Bitcoin? And they're like, you can buy pizza. And I was like, fucking sold. Let's go. So I took the Bitcoin, spent it all on pizza, which we now know the price of a Bitcoin. So there you go. That's Smart investment, expensive pizza in the long run. But, you know, that was like 13 years ago. So,
well, it was the price. It was a pizza cup price pizza at the time, right?
Oh, at the time I was fucking broke as well. So it was great. I just got like, I got pizza. I kept being able to get pizza. I didn't put two and two together and think the price is going up, which is why your ability to buy pizza isn't going down, even though you're spending your Bitcoin. But yeah, you know, whatever, man. But yeah, no, that guy went completely off the rails, you know, like had quite a lot of Bitcoin, you know, didn't need to do shit anymore. It all just went a bit wrong. So
what?
Oh. So I remember when Ethereum launched and I was reading the white paper, and it was a little bit after, I think it was like, you know, it was after Vitalik was giving away fucking, you know, the ETH, and his name was like Vitalik not giving away ETH. Oh. and I think it was like $20, my money, Australian. So like
one freedom dollar or something.
Yeah. And I read the white paper. I was like, this fucking never take off. This is too confusing. And because I'm not a programmer. And I'm like, programmer, what the fuck are this guy on about? He's on crack. There's all these gullible people everywhere buying this shit. And anyway, history. Yeah. At the time, I was making Python bastard fucking some Python together to make a ARB bot for, I think, like XRP on my local exchange or some shit.
I thought you were talking about breeding pythons, my guy. That's
like classic Australian behavior right there.
Yeah. That would have been way more Aussie.
To be honest, could have gone either way there, right?
It's trying my hand at Python, the language, Python 3. Yeah. Anyway, completely lost interest after the ass fell out of everything. And I was not until the 2020s again that I got back into it. So.
Is it still running?
No. Like, I've still got the code, and I looked at it the other day when I was like going through some old files.
Yeah.
And it is not good. But it worked. Yeah. I never actually fully implemented it. It was just like a logging.
Yeah.
You would like just seek the opportunity and then log it out. Because there was no real, you know, and this is probably why it wasn't prolific. It was XRP at the time was like selling for a really big margin. Like there was a big ARB opportunity from the Australian exchanges because there was no real good way to transfer fiat value from Australia to like other exchanges at the time. Now you just have, you know, USDC and USDT. You can just flick that shit back and forth.
Yeah.
But at the time, like there was only the Australian exchanges like BTC Markets and I don't know, whatever. There's this other one, coin something, which, you know, absolutely rapes you. It's one of those dumb ones where you just press the button.
Yeah.
And they didn't have, you know, the Binance or the Kraken or anything like that at the time. But yeah, I was like, you know, I was kind of trying to work out a deal with some I can't remember the guys that trade in currency to like try and quickly move
Forex.
Yeah, Forex, that's it. To try and like quickly move over to American bank accounts, and then getting American bank accounts was a fucking huge pain in the ass. And then, you know, it was all a huge pain. So it was just in the logging thing at the time, and then the ass fell out of everything. And then I was like, yeah, well, fuck this. Back to something else. I just wasted 400 hours.
You decided
it's Japanese. That's how Alameda got started. It's like arbing the Japanese and Korean premiums.
Well, I could have been an Alameda, except I was just a little bit too slow and couldn't figure
You're going
out
for like the hardest possible version of making money possible, rather than just doing the dumb thing in front of your face, which was set up a server and just wait for the money to roll in. And look at you now.
And look at you now. Look at
you now.
Yeah, it was quite interesting. Like, I enjoyed it anyway because I was learning the language and learning APIs and stuff. I knew nothing of APIs and everything at the time, so it was interesting.
And did they make you happy?
Yes, I guess so at the time. Yeah.
Then you gave up.
Bring me long term happiness? Probably not.
I probably
use that knowledge in something else. So.
Yeah.
And you gave up and built an actual Python fucking business, and then
and here you are.
And here you are.
Like a Python breeder. We had some pythons in the backyard somewhere.
There you go.
Sure, you did.
Yeah, I was out emptying the bin, and I heard this rattling in the hedge, and I like peered into the hedge, and I was like,
get some crazy shit down there, right?
Fuck that.
Just a big ass python.
Swimming in like your pool
diamond
shit.
Python carpet snake.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was fucking massive. It was like the length of my room.
Swimming in your pool and shit. So Jasper, what's
swimming in the pool? It was swimming in the hedge.
Swimming in
the hedge. And it was looking at me and I was like, I know you're not poisonous, but I still don't want to, you know, have a problem. So I'm just going to go this way, back inside, turn the air conditioning on, pretend you don't exist. And I haven't seen him since. So it was months ago.
There you go.
Yeah.
So it's probably fine.
I'm sure it's fine. I'm sure he's not in the house somewhere.
Yeah.
Definitely not like.
Confirm fine.
Definitely not like under the kitchen table or anything.
We don't have any rats around here. So I'm sure he's still cruising around somewhere, just eating up the rat population. Nice. I wish he'd eat the fucking possums. We got like these chunky possums that just jump on the roof at night. Our house got like overhanging trees fucking everywhere. And like at 8 or 9 o'clock, you hear this. Hey?
No need to brag.
Your gutter's filled with shit. And we've got a tin roof, right? And so at some point late in the evening, usually 7 or 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, something like that, we must have a possum that weighs a fucking 20 kilos. You hear this bang and then just like cruising up and down the roof.
Eating all those rats.
Yeah, well, yeah. I don't know what the fuck he's doing.
My fucking YouTube algorithm is, that thing is honed, right? And so every once in a while, this dude comes up, this Australian dude. I'll put a link in the notes when we do it. But there's an Australian. What's that?
The pipe guy?
No, not Drain Addict. He's my second favorite. But this guy, he's like a 22 and like a 50 caliber rifle and this massive 22 air rifle with this night scope. And he goes out and he picks off rats, and I didn't realize he has a huge fucking boar issue, like out in the bush or something. There was like,
yeah,
they're fucking mean, and like he's killing like hundreds of these things.
Feral like, hogs?
Yeah, like feral
you
hogs.
The feral hogs meme?
No, what's feral hogs meme?
Well, that's a throwback.
Oh, is it? Shit. No, I feel old. Oh, they shoot that. Yeah, you guys are nodding your head. Fuck you.
They go on, they go on like boar. Culls here in helicopters and just hose those things with automatic weapons.
Dude, that's exactly what it was. Like, he's just picking these things up, and he must have shot 100 of those things.
You've literally seen Wake and Fright, you know.
That's true.
You know that this shit happened.
Yeah. I forgot about Wake and Fright.
15 minute long kangaroo hunt, just like.
Well, the kangaroo piece, I mean, that was like.
There you go, Jasper. Chuck that on your film list, Wake and Fright.
Don't watch it. You know, if you've been on
this show, you have to go and watch that after.
Go watch that movie.
We talked about it as well. That kangaroo hunt was like real. That wasn't.
Yeah. They went out and shot it and like.
They got
the one where they're cruising around in the car?
Yeah.
They got really drunk and then it all got out of hand. And like the people making the film were like, dude, these guys are just like drunk with rifles going nuts. Like, what should we do? And they're like, I guess we keep filming, right?
You fucking let it roll is what you do.
Let it roll. Like, this is all out of hand. So.
I mean, that is pretty standard over here, though.
Which one?
Gun safety only exists within so many kilometers of the sea. Once you get to like that 300 kilometers away from the sea action, gun safety becomes a little bit.
You can just draw a border, like a 300 kilometer border around the whole country.
Yeah, you're inland, like, inside you're like, right. This border, like, you know, don't walk around the bush at night. Cause it's probably a drunk person with a fucking high caliber rifle.
That's funny.
Yeah, because like, you know, it's just them out there, right? Like, I'm going to go drink some whiskey and shoot some kangaroos.
Shoot some shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, these boars, man. And the guy was shooting feral cats too. What the hell? What kind of cat problem is there?
We have, I don't know if you've got anything like this in the States, but we have a dog fence that goes down the border between Queensland and I don't think it is on. It might be on the border. It's either on the border or near the border between Queensland and New South Wales.
Yeah,
and it's to keep feral dogs out of one of those states. I think it's out of Queensland.
How big is it?
It's fucking like the whole border.
No, how tall is the fence?
Oh, it's like, you know, 5 feet tall or something.
Oh, really? So like metal. Like a chain link type of thing, like that?
Yeah, it's just like a
no
semi vermin proof fence.
No shit.
Yeah. And, but there's gates, right? They go through it. And you can, so you get scalps. So you go into the bush and you shoot dogs and then you scalp them and you sell the scalps to the authority that pays you to shoot the dogs.
Yeah, right? Yeah, like a bounty on them or something.
Yeah, but on the fence is like all of these dog carcasses, just like scalped dog carcasses hung on the fence.
For what?
This conversation is just everywhere.
For what? What are they doing? Dogs?
The dogs? They just eat shit. Okay. They like eat all the native animals and stuff. They're just like feral, crazy ass dogs.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Hogs and dogs.
Hogs and dogs.
Yeah, like you don't want them out there, but I mean, it's a bit wild what they when they do, like collecting scalps and stuff. But
yeah, I guess a little. That's a little bushy.
Yeah, but that's the type of shit you come across, you know, outside of that 300 kilometer. Fucking boundary.
Oh man.
Are you in the city, Jasper, or are you like in one of the other country towns? Or
I'm currently in Amsterdam, but I live in Lisbon. So yeah, in the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know where Lisbon is?
Yeah, it's in Portugal, right?
Yeah, there you go. Sorry, I wanted to catch you there. It seemed like you didn't know where it was.
It's where all the crypto people are.
I mean, I couldn't point to it on a map.
That's fair.
I'll just point to Europe and go, it's there.
It's over there. It's west.
Like, you ever been to Europe, Nalo? You must have been.
I've been to like Eastern Europe.
Oh, okay.
Like, you know, Bulgaria and Romania and the Balkans and Croatia and that type of shit, like down that way. I went to Italy, Germany.
You've been to Germany?
Yeah. Oh. I went there for a kebab.
It's not much else to see there, honestly.
So on our way home from like our Eastern Europe trip, we went to a couple of places in Italy. And then when we were flying out, we like went through Germany to fly home because the route seemed more convenient. So we just went in there to like Berlin, went and saw Sinbad, got a very nice kebab, worth every hour of the fucking 5-hour journey it took to get it, and then off to the airport and home. So
just for a kebab.
Oh man, it's fucking magic. It's a lineup. Is it good? Like at 10 a.m. before they open. Yeah, it's like they got like, you know, the open charcoal grill cutting up with veggies and it's really good chips on there. Really good meat. Like the ones we have in Australia, it's like a fucking stick of like ground up shit on a pole where they just like spin in the heat and they're like cutting it off. And you're like, I don't know what is in that shit, but it's salty and delicious.
Is that because
it's not as good as like this stuff we had in Germany. It was awesome.
Is that because it's primarily hogs and dogs?
It could be.